Okay, good afternoon. I'll call to order meeting the State Government Budget Division for Monday, March 1, 2010. Today we're going to be reviewing the governor's recommendations for his budget proposals. And for people, I'll announce this at the start of the meeting and as well as at the end. We hope to have a spreadsheet available tomorrow in my office. So we avoid that frenzy when the budget sheets are handed out and everybody's grabbing them. We'll be going over the spreadsheet at our Wednesday's meeting, but we will have the spreadsheet available tomorrow. We're going to start with the governor's budget recommendations for the Department of Management, Minnesota Management and Budget. Commissioner Hansen is on a secret mission, and so he has to kind of get it out of here real fast. So, Commissioner, welcome back to the Budget Division.
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you for the opportunity to present the governor's recommendations for our Department of Management and Budget before you today. And thank you for the opportunity to be here and for putting me first. As you know, our budget forecast is tomorrow, and getting ready for that has consumed a big part of my day. What I would like to do is walk through with you our recommendations and then see if you have any questions. And I think you're getting the handout that I'm going to be speaking from. First, I wanted to remind you that the Department of Management and Budget is a agency with 304 FTEs and a $21.2 million FY general fund spending number. We're not a large agency. We have numerous enterprise-wide responsibilities, but we're not, as you know, Mr. Chairman, the Department of Human Services that has billions of dollars, or the MDE, Department of Education, that distributes billions of dollars as well. 304 FTEs, $21.2 million in general fund obligations in fiscal 10. As we put together our framework of reductions, we kept in mind some of the priorities that we worked with you on last year. Maintained our strong commitment to strengthening internal controls and our establishment of our internal controls division at MMB, which is up and running. We also have kept in mind our desire to keep SWIFT moving forward with our go live date on July 1st of 2011. Now referring to the sheet in front of you, first thing I want to talk about the unallotment ratification. We're proposing that to make the fiscal year 11 operating unallotment of $459,000 permanent. And the reason in general that the governor has put forward the unallotments to be ratified or approved by the legislature is so that we can, Mr. Chairman, members, book the savings, and it helps our tails in 12 and 13. You can see in this case that it's a $459,000. Primarily, we have realized those savings through vacant positions from people that we have moved from our general fund staff over to the SWIFT project. And there were some other openings that as well that we did not fill. We were able to do this all through the natural attrition at our agency. We didn't lay anybody off. A second area of savings within this unallotment, we continue to realize savings from downsizing our consolidation from our two agencies. We were up on two floors. We're now down to one and a half and have realized some savings there. We continue to realize technology savings from technology investments. Our Treasury Division had a warrant reader give out, and it would have cost us $500,000 to buy a new one. We hired a consultant to help us figure out the best way to replace that technology. That cost us $30,000. Or actually, the consultant cost us $20,000, and we're able to replace the warrant reader with the $30,000 of technology and save the state a lot of money. The second thing I want to talk about, our operating budget. Our recommendation would reduce the general fund operating budget of our agency for $386,000 in fiscal 10 and $599,000 in fiscal 11. It will come about through position and staff reduction, probably through some degree of layoffs. It will also, primarily, I guess, through layoffs. The third thing I want to talk about, the operating reduction in special revenue account. We don't have, like other agencies, like OET or admin or other agencies, we don't have a lot of funds or accounts in our department. And in this case, you see our special revenue account, we pull $9,000 and $11,000 and move it into the general fund. You'll see, Mr. Chairman and members, a theme throughout with the other agencies that have other revenue funds and other accounts that we, in the governor's overall recommendations, we tried to, we carried the 6% reduction into other funds as well. If you turn the page, the non-operating, the 3% operating reduction, the $9 million, when the governor put his budget out, we assigned a 3% across-the-board reduction to agencies, and then we have the equivalent of another 3% to non-operating to the Department of Management and Budget. It's our intent to find enterprise-wide savings through shared services, improve space utilization, professional technical contract reductions, and other efficiency measures. We're in the process of putting these together for discussion with you in the weeks to come, but felt that it would be better to have some enterprise-wide ideas for you. And then in our budget, our language, if they do not come about, the Department of Management and Budget, we will allocate the cuts across all the agencies. It's important to note with the legislature as well as with the constitutional officers, since we didn't feel it was appropriate for us to include the constitutional officers of the legislature in our enterprise-wide activities, we assign them, as you will see when they present their budgets, a 6% reduction. We have eliminated the ARRA contingency for $750,000. If you recall from last session, we set that up. We weren't sure what matching funds we were going to need for federal grants through the ARRA bill over the summer and fall and before we met again. So we set aside $750,000 in the budget that you established last year. That money was not needed at all, and we're moving that for the budget solution. And then the final item, the transition expenditures, we're proposing to take $162,000 from the $500,000 contingency account and utilize that for the incoming governor. If you remember back 8 years ago, there was no fund, and fortunately the Attorney General at the time, Attorney General Hatch, had set some money aside for the incoming governor's transition team. We're hoping that this will help help the new governor so that they don't have to do that. And again, it comes from the contingency account, and so it's not a bottom line cost to the budget. That is my prepared presentation, Mr. Chairman. I'm available for any questions you may have.
Thank you, Commissioner. Now, as to the governor-elect's transition expenses, I don't recall what the cost were for Governor-elect Pawlenty's transition team. Is this $162,000 close to the mark, or how does it compare? I mean, I recognize it's still 8 years old, but is this a valid number that we're going to be working off of for the governor-elect?
Yes, this is a number that we have vetted, that we had worked with a management analysis division that used to be at admin, and you were approved to transfer into our agency. They usually help staff the transition, and this is, as we factored in the expenses, the number we came up with. It's actually more, I think, 8 years ago, it was more, it was a lot less. Do you remember the number? It was a lot. I don't remember the exact number, but it was significantly less.
I don't recall. You mentioned some of the special funds, and although this doesn't apply to MMB as much, the other day we were kind of noticing that there were some issues within not only our budget area but others where we had instances of dedicated fees that were now being sent to the general fund. One issue that did come up within our area was that some charitable gambling organizations were paying a fee so that auditors could be hired by the Gambling Control Board, but now that fee was being sent to the general fund, and we were just trying to identify other instances. Again, from your oversight for the whole budget process, is this something that is throughout the proposed budget? Because it's kind of hard to identify those areas. You got to actually know what you're looking at in order to figure out that's what's happening.
Mr. Chairman, we didn't, all the other funds that we could, we felt the budget solution should be, everybody should participate in its solution. So even though you see a fee-supported activity, we still have gave them a reduction, transferred it into the general fund, but we didn't make it permanent, so it doesn't carry forward. It's a new analysis going forward into 12 and 13 when the biennial budget is done next year. So you will see that in most, I know you don't have the health-related boards, but any boards that you have that have a fee-based activity, you're going to want to take a look. Most of them we assigned a reduction, an operating reduction, and transferred it to the general fund.
I don't know whether there's going to be a supplemental proposal coming out from the governor after tomorrow's forecast, but it did sort of seem that, that this could be a problem in the making, only because in recent years we've had to raise so many fees, just to pay for some basic expenses. And, legislatures, as you may know, typically don't like dedicated funds. But this is the route we've been, and so now these organizations are thinking, well, we're paying these fees, but they're going to the general fund. What's going on? So I think we may have a bit of an issue going on with this budget overall in some of these areas. I'm just looking beyond my own area, too. So.
Okay, and I have, that is a criticism I have heard, Mr.
Okay.
Chairman.
Okay, so we'll see.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is a warrant reader?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olsen, a warrant is a fancy word for a check, a payment that the state sends out, and they call them warrants. And the reader was the machine that produced the warrants, rather expensive. Warrant's another word for check.
Okay. Any other questions for members? Did you wish to present anything further, Commissioner?
No, I don't have any other.
Okay, well, I guess you're free to go back to your secret project.
I have to go back and do my studying for tomorrow.
Yeah, do your homework. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Okay, who wanted to go next?
Do you want to do the Racing Commission?
Racing Commission. let's go to the Racing Commission next, Richard Krueger. Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Dick Krueger, the Executive Director of the Racing Commission, and with me is Ms. Mary Manny, the Deputy Executive Director. I don't have a formal presentation or handouts, although I will explain that during the last legislative session, you did appropriate $899,000 to the Racing Commission from the Special Revenue Fund for regulatory oversight of both of the racetracks. Within that appropriation, we did set up two control accounts, one for Running Aces and one for Canterbury Park. And the 899 is the spending limit that we have, and it is made up of license fees that we collect annually from the from both the racetracks, the ownership license and the racing license, as well as the occupational licenses for all the individuals that work at the racetracks on the front side and the back side, as well as horse owners. Now, of that $899,000, we have budgeted only $761,000. for this year, and in that budget, we are under budget by just over $70,000. So, you know, I don't even want to use the word restraint in spending by the commission, but we've been fortunate enough that we've been able to hire excellent staff to do what they do in the regulatory oversight, including Ms. Manny, who's sitting next to me. And so the governor's holdback of $19,000 the first year and $29,000 the second year are not going to interfere at all with our regulatory oversight for the racetracks, both this year and in 2011. I have begun discussions with staff and some of the racetrack management that if that spending level stays as it is, that we could potentially reduce the statutorily set license fees for both the racetracks. I don't know how often the state has done that as far as reducing license fees, but this would be an opportunity to do that, especially with two racetracks that are experiencing a decline in their revenues, and in one case, and not meeting their projections in the other. So that, Mr. Chairman, is kind of an overview, and members of the committee, an overview of where we are for this this coming biennium, and certainly Ms. Manny and I will stand for any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Kruger. And members, this is at the bottom of page 62, the governor's recommendations. Mr. Kruger, could you, again, talk a little bit more about the special revenue, because is this an area where the legislature appropriated some money to the Racing Commission, but now it's being diverted to the general fund. Is that what's going on here? I'm just trying to get an understanding of what the recommendation of the governor is.
Mr. Chairman, that is my understanding that okay. They would, the money that we get goes into two control accounts in the accounting system, and when you appropriate it and then we set up our budgets, we transfer that money through the accounting system into our operating accounts. So as I understand it, the control accounts will get swept by $19,000, in effect reducing the $899 spending limit to $871,000, and we're budgeted right now at $861,000.
And the purpose for which we appropriated the special revenue, I mean, how do you use that money that we appropriated for what purpose? It's now being diverted to the general fund.
Mr. Chairman, the money that you appropriate to us, you know, covers the salary of 10 full-time, year-round individuals, along with some seasonal employees that we bring in to work in the test barn, and then over and above that, it covers all of our ancillary costs like travel, our supplies and expense, our information technology. You know, prior to running ACES opening, we had six full-time year-round people. Now we have 10, and with the opening of that racetrack, we've added three people up to running ACES, including Ms. Manny, as well as an information technology position. So we've been able to upgrade all of our information technology systems. That's with regard to licensing, the Breeders' Fund system, paramutual auditing, and a little bit of work on the vet system.
Okay, Mr. Lindeen, so is there a way that this could have been handled? There's just a reduction of the agency as opposed to the special revenue? I'm just trying to understand what the recommendation is here.
Yeah, I mean the agency, the Racing Commission, is totally funded with the special revenue. Okay. It's deposited into that special revenue account, the two control accounts that Mr. Kruger was talking about, and then that covers their operating budget. And so what's happening here is like what we were talking about with the Gambling Control Board last week, where then these dollars out of the special revenue fund are being transferred one time to the general fund.
Okay. Anything further, Mr. Kruger? Any questions? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kruger, you stated that the traffic is down a little bit at the racetracks this past, 12 months?
Yeah,
Mr. Kruger.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, yeah, that's correct. Canterbury has been experiencing revenue declines for the last 4 or 5 years, mainly in the paramutual handle. Card club is down, but you know it's sustaining itself. But their parimutuel revenues have been declining for the last 4 years.
Now, Mr. Chair, there's growing discussion from time to time to expand the gambling operation at these places, and we're given a perspective that that would draw in more cash flow and sustain it, not only sustain it, but make it a regular cash flow account for the state of Minnesota. Is it typical when the economy is down that the gambling interest follows? I've kind of remember hearing that when the economy's down, those places are on the rise. Now, is that what really is it?
From
your perspective,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, Canterbury has been experiencing declines prior to the recession that began in December of 2007. Part of that was the gambling on the internet. You know, people were already handicapping and betting on horses, but with the poker now online, that did impact Canterbury. I don't know if I can answer the question regarding the recession. My intuition is that it did, that people have probably pulled back a little bit on what they're using their disposable income on. And then the poker took off shortly after Canterbury opened, and that craze has also declined over the last 4 or 5 years. I don't know if I've answered your question, Senator, but.
Well, Mr. Chair, I remember shortly after I graduated from college, there was a big tennis fad. Everybody was playing tennis, and the tennis courts all over the state were full, and people were waiting, and cities put in more tennis courts. And they put in these coin-operated lights, and within 2 years, nobody played tennis anymore.
And, somebody does, but yeah.
Someone must. I haven't seen them, but they must be somewhere. But I, in kind of judging where we go on expanding gambling in the state of Minnesota, especially at these racino plans that are out there, I'm kind of wondering, in light of a downward tracking of activity, whether or not that's a direct relationship with the economy or not, we should kind of keep that in mind as we consider expanding things, maybe for a fad, maybe not. You never know if it's a fad until it's over. And so I think we should be a little cautious on that, and I think the testimony today does reflect that some of this traffic pattern does change. And I hope we aren't getting to the point where when we do come up with that public policy decision, or when we're faced with that later on, that we kind of keep some of this conversation in mind.
Okay, Mr. Krueger, anything? Any other questions of Mr. Krueger or the Racing Commission? Okay, thank you. And okay, then the Office of the State Auditor. The Auditor Otto is here. Welcome back to the Budget Division. How's business?
Mr. Chair, members, Rebecca Otto, the state auditor. Do you want me to answer that question, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
Business is good.
Good.
Unfortunately. There's lots of work for us to do, but we're doing our best. You're not giving out money today, right?
Not today.
Darn it. Okay.
Check if it's check later on. See.
Okay, I'll check.
Forecast comes out tomorrow, so.
Maybe it'll be really good.
Ask Mr. Hansen, he's on the house.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members, I believe today you'd like me to address the governor's budget recommendations.
Yes.
And the impact it would have on my office. And his recommendation, I'm not sure if it's going to match the numbers you have, but it was $32,000 for fiscal year 10. And
64. Page 64. Okay, go ahead.
Sorry.
Oh, no, I'm just letting us know.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I don't know if the numbers match up with yours. There was a slight miscalculation on our office, and so it's supposed to be $32,000 for fiscal year 10 and then $78,000 for 11, 12, and 13.
Okay.
All right. And the impact it would have on my office, as you...
Auditor Otto, could you repeat those numbers here?
I'm sorry, yes.
Because the governor's he shows your operating budget for 2010 is 32, and he shows 2011 as 110, 2012 is 110, and 2013 is 110. But you say those numbers are incorrect?
Yes, Mr.
Okay.
Chair. And they told us that they were, as long as Matt, correct me if I'm incorrect, but they basically said they weren't going to issue any corrections, but it was miscalculated.
Okay.
So it was 32 and then 78, 78, 78.
Okay. Apparently that was a problem with all the constitutional officers, including the governor's office?
Including
the governor's office and the legislature, so.
Okay.
They miscalculated all of them, so.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, members, that's... what they have recommended, and you know how I'm always very firm about how our office can't go backwards. However, this would basically equate to one FTE in my office. It would come out of Job Z. It would not result in a layoff, which is the good news. And that program has been an evolving program, and we've tried to get a handle on it, and indeed made lots of changes, and we're still monitoring it, so we can do it.
Okay. Any questions, the auditor? Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Madam Auditor, as we've heard from, you know, revenue and Minnesota management and budget, that it's been so hard to get auditors and bookkeepers and, you know, financially trained people and then keep them in the state employment. How is that picture helping with your area now, and how is this going to affect it, do you think?
Madam Auditor.
Mr. Chair and members, I would say in general, anytime you have auditors, you know, revenue has the same issue. If we lose them in budget cuts, it's a travesty to our state, because it's actually, they do get recruited by private sector, and also by local governments that pay a lot more than state government. And so luckily in this particular situation, we won't be losing anybody. We're not laying anybody off, because we did not fill the position because of the tenuous nature of Job Z, and program has not settled down yet from what we can tell. But we can't go backwards on our auditors. It's not possible. Otherwise, we will not. It's not in the best interest of the public. We're here to make sure that when money is appropriated to local governments, that there's proper oversight. And in an economic downturn, it's really critical. So I would say with revenue or anyone else that may be losing auditors, it'll be government auditing and government work isn't always taught in the schools and in the universities. And so they learn in government, and we train them. And then if you lose them, the state loses an asset that we put a lot of resources into. And so I would... for some of the other ones that I've been talking to about the impact it'll have, it's very difficult to lose that type of technical knowledge, and it's very hard to gain it back because you start over again.
Any other questions for the auditor? Well, thank you, and you may have come in after, I'll repeat it again. We'll have a spreadsheet available for my budget division sometime tomorrow, and so we don't have... throw it out there and everybody have mad scramble for it. So we'll have people knowing what the proposals are, at least trying to meet our target here. I recognize the budget forecast is going to come out tomorrow, but I don't think there's any expectation, regardless of what the forecast says, it's going to change my target numbers appreciably. I mean, I might get a little fudge factor here and there, but, what I've got is, I think, what I'm working off of, so.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just say one more thing, please. Yeah. In terms of, I'm not sure if your targets will meet or what you're doing is going to meet what the governor is recommending, but in terms of any other division going backwards in my office, there is nothing there. We have to do the work. There's stimulus funds, and we're, I would say, struggling right now to do the work we're required to do. The feds have actually changed. They're changing deadlines. They've increased our workload, and we still have to get it done with the same people, and it was already hard. So... understandable that you have targets you have to meet and that your work is very difficult, but the oversight has got to be there. So,
Sir Robling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering, when you said that the feds have changed their regulations, when they gave us stimulus money, did any of that money get targeted for oversight and auditing, or was that just an extra thing that was thrown on us?
I think the answer was no.
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling. Yeah, the answer is no. And the state auditors, we were talking regularly on conference calls every couple weeks, because you know, they do change things, and workloads do change, and they tend to get bigger, and then the costs go up for local governments, and so there were changes, and we really tried to make noise to say, wait a minute, state budget deficits are there for almost every state in our country, and we're not able to go to the legislature and ask for much more. Now, the beauty of our budget is 80% of our costs are, you know, we get fees and reimbursements for, so in terms of the impact on the general fund, it's not, we're not great. We're very, very, very small. The state has been exploring, and I don't know that they've gotten it yet, trying to, there's an indirect cost element they can do with some of the oversight work in administration. We may be able to be a part of that, but that doesn't necessarily provide a lot of relief for anybody. But no, there's accounting standards board, there's all these different groups that change things, and then we have to respond, which is kind of the normal course of business for auditors in general, but especially government auditing. But yeah, this one, it was a quick-moving train, and we, the state auditors, tried to shape it as much as we could, and also to say, be really careful with what you guys do to us, because we're already managing large workloads and smaller staff, and so if that answers your question.
Terribly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the issue of the Job Z program, and you said that you had an unfilled position, whether she would just probably leave unfilled to take care of this, are there less communities applying for that, or is it smaller than had been anticipated, the participation in it, or how can we step back auditing that program?
Head monitor.
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, I'll try to be brief on this one. When we were given the oversight duty, we weren't able to get our hands on certain data. We finally got that another session, and we finally got an appropriation to try to do the work. When we looked at the work, the problem was is the whole program was changing because there had been a legislative audit report saying there were a lot of issues with Job Z. So DEED was doing overhauling. There were some Senate bills to overhaul. I think the Senate bills never made it through. DEED did their own overhaul. And in the process, it's really now more of a state program than it is a local government program. The DEED has really taken on more of the management and oversight. Local governments don't have that much authority in it anymore. So we normally oversee local government, not state government. And also, everything was in paper and not electronic, and we didn't get an appropriation that would ever begin to help us dig through paper. And so we begged DEED to make it electronic so that we could actually do some spot checking on it. And also, there were unenforceable contracts when we looked at it, so there's not much we can do with that either. The contracts were a mess, but they were cleaning that up. There was a better contract. We're still in the monitoring phase, to see if further changes are made. I think they're trying to get an electronic database put together, but it really was in very poor shape. And in terms of outcomes, we don't do performance evaluations, but from some of the numbers I've seen, the program needs revisiting. So,
thank you.
Okay, any other questions to the auditor? Okay, thank you, Madam Auditor. See you soon. Okay, next is the Secretary of State. That's on page... Mr. Galdman. 63. Okay, Mr. Galdman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Galdman. I'm the Deputy Secretary of State, and I appreciate the opportunity to come before you and talk about the governor's budget, the governor's proposed budget reduction for the Secretary of State's office. Again, as the state auditor mentioned, there is a correction that will be coming over from MMB. The numbers that you have before you say that we are being cut by $104,000 in fiscal year 10 and $354,000 in fiscal years 11, 12, and 13. The correction that will be coming over from MMB, as I understand it, is a $104,000 cut in fiscal year 10 and $250,000 cut in 11, 12, and 13. Mr. Chair, we recognize the financial difficulties of the state this year, and we also recognize the fiscal tsunami that is headed for the state in fiscal years 12 and 13. And we are willing to do our part to help out in keeping the state budget balanced. We've done our part in the past years. I'll give you one example is that in fiscal years 2006 and 2007, our revenues, our appropriation from the legislature was $11,905,000. For fiscal years 10 and 11, Our appropriation is $11,819,000, a reduction of about $86,000. What number doesn't show is between those two bienniums, our office was also given the responsibility for administering the Safe at Home program. It's a program to protect the location of any individual who fears for their safety, battered women, battered men, others who need to protect the location where they are living from a potential abuser. And that program is a $360,000 per biennium program to administer. So not only has our budget gone down, our responsibilities have gone up since 2006, 2007. Bottom line, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the proposal that the governor has given us is reasonable. What I would caution you is that how we spread that cut across our agency is going to be difficult. As you know, the Secretary of State has the constitutional responsibility of administering elections. In addition to the constitutional responsibility of administering elections, we have a federal mandate because we receive Help America Vote Act dollars. We have a federal mandate that requires us to maintain our effort, the same historical effort that we have spent on elections in previous years for all future years. And therefore, between our constitutional responsibility and our maintenance of effort responsibility in elections, even though the 6% cut that the governor has proposed comes off our entire budget, including the elections division, very little of that money will be able to be taken out of our elections budget because of the maintenance of effort and because of our constitutional responsibility to administer fair, accurate elections, train election judges, and everything that goes along with that. The other point that I'd like to make before I open it up to questions is that our agency is a bit unique. We generate a considerable amount of revenue. That revenue goes into the general fund with the exception of a small dedicated revenue stream and also a special surcharge that will expire on June 30th of 2011. All of our revenue goes into the general fund, and then the legislature appropriates back to us the amount of money that we need for that for our operations. And to give you some an idea, in fiscal year 10, we will be generating $14.6 million in fees, and our general fund appropriation will be $5.9 million. So we're a net producer of revenue for the general fund.
Well, I think on the positive side, you don't have a U.S. Senate race on the ballot this year. That's a good thing.
Yes, Mr. Chair, it is.
So do we get any maintenance fit for credits for the fact that we spent an extra amount of time last year on that race? Or the feds don't count that, do they?
Mr. Chair, the feds don't count that. The feds count each year that you have to maintain the same amount because we did spend more last year. Not a lot more. We did it in a very effective and efficient manner to do the recount with the help of a lot of local government officials. The 87 counties did a lot of the work for us. We reimbursed them to the tune of, I think, 3 cents per ballot, if I'm not mistaken, but to help us with the recount. But in all, it cost us about $200,000 in additional general fund money to do the recount, but we can't credit that to fiscal year 10 or 11.
Okay. Even though we don't have a U.S. Senate race on the ballot, that doesn't say that one of the other statewide races or even a congressional race or something like that, you know, couldn't wind up, you know, going into a recount that, you know, could be long and drawn out. I can't imagine anything like the 2008 U.S. Senate race, but you know, is your office in a position prepared for, you know, another expensive recount battle if one is necessary?
Mr. Chair, knock on wood, there will not be another recount necessary. Yeah. We've had a bill last year that actually would have reduced the possibility of a recount. Little minutia here. The Senator Coleman, Al Franken race, had there been a difference of 15,000 votes, there would have had to be a mandatory recount because it's 0.5% of the total votes cast. The difference actually after the canvassing board met was 210 votes. And we all know that that changed after we did some of the voting challenges and after the election contest and after the Supreme Court got involved. We felt that that 0.5% was too large of a number for a recount. Unfortunately, that bill, which was passed into law, was vetoed last year by the governor. So we're still stuck with the 0.5%. And one of our greatest fears is a primary. Because a primary election, not only is there a possibility of a mandatory recount, you also have to be able to do that very quickly in order to get your general election ballot out in time to get it to the military and overseas voters 45 days. It has to be available 45 days before the general election. We are prepared. We always have a contingency plan, but those plans don't come free. They will cost money.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Roebling.
Thank you. On the issue of reducing the number of votes or the percent of the number of votes to trigger a recount, is that in one of the bills that is moving through the legislature again this year?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, yes, it is.
Okay. And Mr. Chair?
Senator Roebling.
I have another question. You mentioned before that it's costing your office $360,000 on the program that is designed to keep voting, I think it was designed to keep voting records away from people who might be wanting to do harm to someone. So if there was an order for protection, that those the person's voting records could be kept private. Is that what you're talking about? And I mean, is it getting widely used? And how would it cost $360,000?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, it goes well beyond keeping the voting records private. It, essentially, the system, the way it works is anyone who can demonstrate a reasonable fear for their safety. And in fact, we have, I'm not sure if we have law enforcement officials signed up for the program because the people who are in the program are anonymous. But we do have law enforcement officials that have inquired about the program. Anyone who fears for their safety, what they do is they establish a P.O. box with us, and that only our office, and there's only two people in our office who know the actual address that that person is living at. And then what we do is then we forward that mail that's addressed to our P.O. box to the address that the individual is living at. Most of the individuals that are participating, who are participating in this program, are abused spouses, abused boyfriends, abused girlfriends, and the like. But what they do is they have to meet criteria of being fearful of their safety, demonstrate that there's a reasonable fear that they need protection as to where they live. And we work with Department of Public Safety that their identity is not listed on their driver's license. And we're working with all other organizations like the NSP to make sure that NSP and Minnegasco and other utility companies mail the bill to this P.O. box. So if anyone ever got a hold of their letter or ever got a hold of the database from NSP or the elections database or the driver and vehicle service database, they would only see the P.O. box, and they would not see the home address of that person. And it gives that person some sense of security that they can live safely in their home. It was actually a program that was initiated by Secretary Kiffmeyer. She recommended the program, and then it began being implemented, actually, when Secretary Ritchie assumed office.
Mr. Chair, do you have a lot of participants in it currently?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, I believe we have over 200 participants currently in the program. I think in the at one point or another, people go in the program and come out of the program as they move out of state and the like. I think over the course of the program's history, we probably served 300 to 400 people. I don't have the exact numbers with me, but that's about the numbers that we're serving.
Mr. Chair, and what kind of FTE do you have assigned to the program?
We have 1¾ FTE assigned to the program. The majority of the cost, well, not the majority, but a large portion of the cost is the forwarding of all of the mail, because we have to put new postage on that mail and send it to the right address, put it in a new envelope and send it to the correct address. So that's where a lot of the cost comes in into play, in addition to the FTE salaries.
Okay, thank you.
So what kind of mail is being sent to that post office address that you have to forward? Do you have any? I mean, obviously you're not opening it. Are these bills? Are they junk mail? What kind of things are you?
Basically, once the individual is admitted into the Safe at Home program, they are eligible to give out that post office box address to anyone that they believe needs their address, whether it be a credit card, whether it be a utility bill, whether it be any other organization that has a need to send a letter to them. Even personal correspondence will often go to the post office address as opposed to the the actual address of the individual. I have with me Beth Frazier, who actually knows and supervises directly the individuals who work for the Safe at Home program, and she may be able to answer any of your other questions in greater detail.
But she's not one of the two people that actually knows who the people are, right?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe she is even one of the two people. I believe it's the main staff person and the clerical support person who actually keep the list.
Ms. Fraser, anything further on Safe at Home that you want to talk about? I know you just came in here, so.
Mr. Chair and members, Beth Fraser with the Office of the Secretary of State. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Any other questions of the Secretary of State's office? Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Gelman and Ms. Fraser. Okay, thank you. Attorney General's office, do we have someone here? Yes. Welcome to Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Rebecca Sparks, and I am the Director of Administrative Services for the Attorney General's Office.
This is page 55. Go ahead.
As you know, the Attorney General is the Chief Legal Officer for the state of Minnesota, and in that role in calendar 2009, we were able to return $27 million to various funds within the state and to defend successfully against claims against the state, which saved agencies $83 million. We are a service agency, consequently we are 85% salary and about 15% operations. With previous cuts, what we've done is to try to squeeze our operations further, and we have held open openings or delayed hirings. With the proposed cut, which will be $436,000 in FY10, $954,000 in 2011, $954,000 in 2012, and $954,000 in 2013. We have determined that we will have to do a reduction in workforce. We have not determined who we will be reducing. We will also have to look at the legal services that we provide currently to see if there's anything that we don't desperately need to provide to agencies. That's all I have to say.
Ms. Sparks, the other two constitutional officers told us that the numbers that we had from the governor's supplemental budget were incorrect. Do you know if you've got...
These are the adjusted numbers.
Okay, so 436 in the first year and 1230 each year after that?
954 in each
okay,
year.
Okay, so, I mean, because we're working off the governor's February 15th one, so it's 954?
Correct.
954 in each of the 3 years, not 1390. Okay. Gotcha.
That's better.
Well, again, obviously, because most of the Attorney General's office deals with people numbers, if there is a cut, it is going to affect people not, you know, I mean, people are going to have to be laid off or something, and it just means fewer things the office can do. I mean, is that a fair summary?
Mr. Chair, that is a fair statement.
Okay. And obviously, those decisions can't be made until the budget's actually done, but okay. Okay, any questions to the Attorney General's office? Okay, well, thank you, Ms. Bartz. Finally, we have the Governor's recommendations on the Department of Revenue. Commissioner Salamone. Welcome back. Please identify yourself for the record. This is page 63.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the opportunity to come back. With me is Dan Ostick, the director of our Financial Management Division. As I understand it, the focus here is the governor's supplemental budget, so I'll walk you through the key items in that budget. The first is for our agency, a 3% cut in our operating budget, which will be applied to the non-compliance portion of our department. You recall from a presentation the last time I was here that we sort of the department is bifurcated into direct compliance activities, which are two-thirds of the department budget, and one-third compliance support, as I call them, backroom functions, HR and so on. So this this cut will apply to the non-compliance section of the department, that one-third. That will be a cut for the agency of $1.27 million, general fund money, and approximately $17,000 from the healthcare access fund. The implication of this cut will be potentially 22 full-time equivalents being either laid off or vacated through attrition. That's consequence of the budget cut. The second piece of the governor's supplemental budget is an appropriation for an additional tax compliance initiative. This particular one would appropriate roughly $6.7 million to the Department of Revenue for increased compliance activities with a gross return of $26.8 million. A net return of $20.1 million roughly. That's a projected ROI of 4 to 1 rate of return on those dollars. This initiative would involve the hiring of 70 additional full-time equivalent positions. All of those positions would be assigned generally to the direct compliance activities of the department. The third item in the governor's supplemental budget is a proposal to change the threshold for the mandatory filing of returns. It adopts a federal e-file threshold requiring tax preparers to e-file if they prepare more than 10 income tax returns. Currently, that threshold is 100 returns. This particular recommendation would involve administrative savings to the Department of Revenue of approximately $78,000 per year. And finally, the unallotment, the 2.25% unallotment is under the governor's proposal would be made permanent for fiscal year 2011. The operating unallotment amounts to $950,000 per year. And most of that, or all of that money would be reflected in our tax system management portion of our budget. Well, those are the key initiatives that the governor has in his supplemental budget that relate to the Department of Revenue.
Thank you, Commissioner. You know, I did. You know, I had some concerns about the, and we talked about this at your last appearance here, about the tax compliance, whether or not, you know, that was a realistic number and so forth. We don't need to go over that, but I did want to share with you something I think, a bill that I'm working on we've been in touch with the Department of Revenue on, and it deals with the display that you see out there on puppy mills. Now, I didn't put the display out there, but, you know, but that's my bill. And, you know, we were trying to find a way to pay for the bill because you're going to have inspectors if the bill passes and so forth. So we just want to get kind of an idea of how many of these breeders that are out there, you know, have their sales tax permits and how much they're collecting on sales tax, so we can get an idea of how much. It came back to me that very few of these breeders have sales tax permits. Mm-hmm. Now, you don't need my bill to, you know, to do anything about it. That's the law. They should have sales tax permits because they're breeding all these cute little puppies and kittens and so forth and selling them, some out of good conditions, some out of very bad conditions. But the fact is, if you're doing that, you gotta have a permit, you gotta be collecting sales tax, you gotta be remaining the state. So I just encourage the department, if you're looking for more revenue with all these tax compliance folks, I think I found an area where you can start finding some money.
Mr. Chair, we always welcome leads, particularly from chairs of legislative committees. So
and,
we'll be happy
and
to
you
look
know what?
That.
I mean, we can give you the list of all the USDA breeders in the state. We can give you the list of all those people who are advertising online or on the internet or in newspapers and so forth that claim they're selling all these animals. And I just think they ought to have a sales tax permit, and I think they may collect the sales tax. Sir, we'll see.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Commissioner, could you address the healthcare access expenditure line there? Because I was curious, number one, what it is and if it would be affected by if general assistance medical care, if those people are shifted into Minnesota care, is that going to change those numbers dramatically?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, I think the amount shown, the $17,000, relates to the MinCare tax. I'm not sure how the number was derived. I'll have to look into that. Unless you have, is that the 3%? Okay, so it's 3% of the tax revenue. I'm sorry, 3% of the healthcare access fund.
Yeah,
so is that Minnesota care? Is that?
Yes.
Well then, you know, somewhere it must show in the governor's budget that as he's switching those people from GAMC to Minnesota Care, and we've heard that it depletes the account in 6 months. So are these not coordinating with each other? Because that's the number that we've been told, is that the transfer will just destroy Minnesota Care and it'll be out of funds in approximately 6 months. So that would mean that this number would be totally inaccurate, I would think. I don't know.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, I think that's perhaps a topic you might want to address with MMB, or we could check with them and get back to you on that.
One last follow-up. So what is your oversight on this, that it's not all in Department of Health? Because I thought Minnesota Care was actually in Department of Health, and so I don't really know why it's a line item in your budget, but...
I believe it's for the administrative costs that we incur in dealing with the MinCare tax.
They collect it.
Yeah, they collect the tax.
Okay. Mr. Chair, one last question, I guess, if I may.
Yeah.
And that would be, I am a little surprised that they haven't come running to you and said, you know what, if we do this, we're not going to have a Minnesota Care in 6 months, period. And so I'm a little aware I'm a little concerned that there hasn't been that conversation with your department, because you're a part of administering it, so. But I'm glad you will look into that. I appreciate that.
Senator Rust?
Mr. Chairman, just going back to your sales tax question, whether it's on the breeders or some other group, I'm curious about how you go about estimating which taxpayers who owes or in which sectors. Taxpayers who are not paying the sales tax, how you go about estimating what you're going to get on your compliance initiative.
And before he answers that, let me just tell you that the way we stumbled into it was that, you know, we assumed there was a higher number and revenue came back with a fairly low number. We said, we know there's a lot of breeders in this state. And so obviously, you know, we had to compare known information with what was reported to revenue, and so they're still estimating a low number, but we know it's a much higher one. Commissioner?
Oh,
sure. Do you understand what I'm...
come up with your numbers?
For example, in your estimate, did you include pet breeders who do not remit sales tax on their sales.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, for purposes of calculating the yield of a tax compliance initiative, mm-hmm. we generally look at the average amount of revenue we get from our auditors on a per capita basis and use that data to calculate what we think we can do given a certain appropriation.
So, Mr. Chairman, it's not sector specific that you think are that in a given area you would have expected more sales tax revenue than that is coming in. It's not done that way. It's done by what your expectations are of an auditor, no matter what sector, business sector, they happen to be auditing for sales tax receipts.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I think it's a combination of the general calculation, and then we have within our collections division, our audit divisions, they all have sort of little projects, special projects that they may target a certain sector or a certain industry, and to the extent that they can estimate what they would expect to get from those projects that would be added to the compliance initiative.
So, Mr. Chairman, if that's the case, although it would seem reasonable that if they're not collecting it from those folks, that would be a way to pay for your initiative, nevertheless, the revenue estimate would not come back that way because the revenue estimate, it assumes that everybody is obeying the law and paying sales tax. So, you can't depend on that source of revenue, even if there was some really aggressive auditor who went after pet breeders. That money would just go back into the general fund.
Senator Rest, it just became a curiosity issue, wondering if that was a possible source. We're not concerned about that. But, again, there's a lot of money being made in the state, a lot of money changing hands from these people who breed puppies and kittens, some in very good condition, some in very bad conditions. And most of them don't have sales tax permits.
I would assume that the pet stores do, but just not the individual.
But those aren't the breeders. The pet stores are not the breeders. The people who breed them, some sell to pet stores, some don't. It's the people who actually are making all the money. And I'm just pointing it out, Commissioner. There's probably a lot of money out there that you can start going after.
Thank you, Mr.
Really
Chair.
Help with the budget.
Please, when you're thinking tax compliance, think of all these breeders. Okay. Senator Roebling.
I have a quick question on this. And it has to do with the pets. So if somebody has a dog that kind of inadvertently gets bred and they want to give the puppies away, but they're told don't give the puppies away because everybody should pay something for it because they value them more and they'll be better taken care of. So they charge $20 for the puppies, put the ad in the local paper, or put a sign out by the road. Are those people supposed to have sales tax permits too and collect sales tax when they sell their puppies?
Mr. Chair, sure. Senator Roebling, I think to the extent that it's considered a sale, it would be taxable. If it's just given away, obviously I don't think there would be a tax there. Senator Resmi, you want to check me on that?
Isn't there kind of like an occasional sales exclusion?
Yes.
So if you just had two or three puppies, you wouldn't have to charge, and you only did it one time. You weren't in the business. You wouldn't have to charge sales tax. We in the 90s, we went through year after year after year trying to even define what an occasional sale was because some people were in the business of occasional sales, and we had to get around that with definitions. But the instance you're describing would not occasion a person to have to get a sales tax permit.
But if you got 20 animals that you're breeding,
that's different.
That's way different. Right?
Thank you. And Ms. Commissioner Salamone, I was also going to ask you, have we done any comparisons with other states as to auditing efforts, the number of auditors that we have that are out there doing audits for state tax purposes compared to, like, Wisconsin. Is our enforcement a great deal more aggressive or less aggressive than our neighboring states, for example?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, I think we are certainly an aggressive state. We certainly have not been accused of being less than aggressive. And I think it's good that we try to be as aggressive as we can within the limits of, you know, sort of reasonableness. As far as comparisons, I think I've seen only one sort of multi-state comparison of sort of number of auditors and average yield per auditor, and I might be able to dig that up, but there's not been, to my knowledge, a systematic comparison across all 50 states. And the logical organization to do that would be our trade association, the Federation of Tax Administrators, and certainly can check in with them to see if they've done anything like that.
Mr. Chair.
Sir Roebling.
Because my concern is that we get a reputation for being so aggressive that it's just one of those other negative things about Minnesota when we hear, oh, you're overly regulated, you have too many rules, and they're on your case all the time. And I'm not saying that they're all committing any type of fraud or even doing anything, but just the time, again, spent on going through audits is very time-consuming, and businesses want to avoid it, you know, whenever possible, because it is an expense for any business to go through.
Okay. Anything further? Okay, thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Okay, members, that wraps it up for today. As I've indicated, while we know the forecast comes out tomorrow, we've been given a budget target to prepare for this division. I'll have a spreadsheet available tomorrow, you know, for the interested parties, and we'll be talking about it you know, at our meeting on Wednesday. I can't imagine, you know, the forecast changing the targets at all. I mean, unless there's this $1.2 billion deficit becomes a $3 billion surplus. I mean, unless something happens like that, and that's not going to happen. So it's probably not going to require much adjustments. So we'll have a spreadsheet available. Mr. Boddard will also have a bill draft for our budget area. It's the normal stuff, but he'll have that available by Wednesday. So we'll be able to have a chance to look it over on Wednesday, see what you think about it. Obviously, if you want to get a copy tomorrow, you can do so from my office, and then we'll start reviewing it and seeing what direction this budget division wants to go in. So, any questions? If not, we'll see you on Wednesday. Thank you. Meeting adjourned. Okay.